Good morning. Playback this week is coming to you not from an RTE studio as normal, but from my living room in deepest, darkest Wicklow. Precautionary remote working? Perhaps. A convenient excuse for my colleagues to get me out from under their feet? More likely. So it's going to be a small miracle if we're going to get through this next hour without an interruption from a child unaccustomed to housework begging for schools to be reopened. Because this was the week that the national penny dropped, that we were living in a new world.
Coronavirus land, it's a new world that we haven't been in before, and we need to start adapting to that reality.
Susan Mitchell, the Sunday Business Post's excellent health correspondent, was on This Week, pouring a bucket of icy water over the heads of anyone still feeling in any way complacent about the pandemic. She got figures from within the HSE that contemplate the probability of literally half the country getting COVID-19.
Because one of the real concerns that senior health officials have is that about 50% of those infected could present over a three-week window. I know that over in England, their chief medical officer has said the exact same thing. And the numbers are indeed stark. Effectively, what the National Public Health Emergency Team has done is, and it's, I believe, set to publish the figures next week, so they are very much almost completed, outlined three possibilities. One in which a best case scenario in which 30% of the population would be infected, a worst case scenario in which 50% of the population would be infected, and then the 1.9 million figure reflects a 40% infection rate, which is the one that at this moment in time they think is more likely, so that's what they're preparing for.
Professor Sam McConkie was in studio with David McCullough to translate that figure of 1.9 million into how many could die.
Our best case scenario we've passed. The best case scenario is now that it would look like a regular flu. My middle scenario is that we'd have a 20% attack rate and 20,000 deaths. We normally have 30,000 deaths in a year in this country, David. So that's almost two-thirds of the year's deaths all in one epidemic. And the worst case scenario is potentially up to an 80% attack rate. You heard Susan talking about this. So it could be an 80% of that's 4 million. And again, the 2% death rate. It could even be 3 or 4% because a lot of the people in China haven't recovered yet. So it could be 2 or 3% of those 4 million people will die. So again, I know you're good on the numbers. That's 80,000 to 120,000 deaths. So when you say it's all just something we can let blow through, that's not a good option. You've got to work through the simple numbers and see what you're really asking for there.
And if you have a problem getting your head around the numbers, Professor McConkie had a metaphor.
The best metaphor I can think of is the Spanish flu mixed up with the Irish Civil War, mixed up with the 1929 stock market crash, all together at the same time.
Okay. Metaphors aside, what is it literally like when you get the virus? Different for different people, of course. But on Wednesday, Sean O'Rourke talked to Conor Reid, who had gotten the virus and then pneumonia, about the symptoms and the distinctive cough associated with COVID-19.
You're coughing from the bottom of your lungs. It's really weird. It's hard to describe, but it's not just like a normal cough. It's really deep inside you, and the cough comes from the... It's like you're trying to get rid of something from in the middle of your lungs.
And without being too graphic, I mean, were you coughing up anything when you were at that phase?
No, but it felt like I needed to. And that was the weird part about it. It felt like I was coughing to get rid of something, but nothing was coming out. I was coughing so much that I barely got any sleep. It was a case of lying down and coughing all night.
And just continuously so?
Continuously so, yeah. And there was not much that I could do about it. It just kept happening.
What about things like runny noses and headaches? Did they apply in your case?
It wasn't a case of a runny nose. It was a case of a blocked nose. And it really was a blocked nose. And it started to block up the sinuses. And that's when I had ear problems and my balance was affected. It's like a blocked nose, but 10 times worse.
And the fever?
The fever, that was quite bad. However, it wasn't really, really bad. I could still function around the house by myself. It wasn't a case of shutting myself away. It was a case of going through hot spells and cold spells and sweating without reason to sweat.
Yeah, and you're there in Wuhan, where, as I said at the outset, this all began. Now, are things getting back to normal there? I mean, how's your own life been since?
we're still under quarantine, so there's no way that the quarantine is going to be lifted anytime soon. Just because the Chinese government wants to be 100% sure that there won't be another outbreak. If they release the quarantine too early and people start going back on the streets and the infection starts growing again, we'll have to go back to stage one and it'll be quarantined all over again. That's something that they really do want to avoid, so they're going to be extra cautious. Middle of next month is when the quarantine will be released.
And are you in isolation yourself now?
Yeah, so the whole city is in isolation. Where everybody's in their apartments, in their houses. We really can't leave. The only time that we can leave is when we need to buy supplies like groceries and that sort of thing.
The maths may say that the worst case scenario is for anywhere between 80 and 120,000 people to die. But that's still very hard to get your head around as actually ever going to happen. Time perhaps to ask, has it ever happened before? And for the benefit of the heart of history, Dr. Ida Milne was called in this week by The History Show. She has written extensively about the Spanish flu in the Ireland of 100 years ago. And yes, yes, I know, it's a different disease and those were different times. But there are still lessons to be learned.
Well, you know, it has many echoes of today that you see lots of like conspiracy theories. Where did this disease come from? You know, was it a biological terror weapon? In 1918, they thought that Bayer was infecting aspirin with the flu and that was a kind of a weapon, a German chemical weapon of war as well, you know, that they were trying to fight the war on another front. So all these conspiracies are very common. And panic is also common because people tend to think in crisis situations that governments are hiding things from them. And the way governments...
Well, they were right in 1918 because the reason why we called it the Spanish flu was because people were only aware of the fact that people were dying of flu in Spain, whereas they were dying in the trenches wholesale, weren't they?
Exactly. They were trying to keep it hidden from the enemy so that they wouldn't be weakened and the enemy attacked them where the flu was hitting. So right from the very beginning, I suppose, secrecy is built into the 1918 flu. And then people always think that something is being hidden. So the way governments can combat that is by being very open and making sure that they pass on good information.
Let me butt in on Ida for a second with news on The Tuberty Show from Cameron O'Connor living in Singapore of how they deal with people knowingly spreading misinformation there about COVID-19.
A lot of people are freaking out because, and thankfully I'm not online, but a lot of people, when I say online, on social media, because they're reading, you know, gossip and rumours and misinformation. How are they approaching that in Singapore?
Yeah, there was a rumour went around that a maid had died and contacted her boss had been to China. And the government immediately came out with these text messages that go to pretty much everyone saying, it's not true, they died of something else, we've tested it. And we remind you about the penalties for starting misinformed rumours if we can get you.
Back to Spanish flu researcher Ida Milne. Miles Dungan asked her, how many did it kill in Ireland?
Officially 20,057, according to the Registrar General, died from flu. I have added in about 3,000 excess pneumonia deaths to that, looking, you know, taking an average over 10 years. 23,000. I think it's quite conservative because I think doctors were far too busy treating the ill to be that much worried about registering the dead. But from that, I estimated, along with Dr. Anthony Kinsler, who's a medical statistician, that there's probably about 800,000 cases on the island, about if the fatality rate is 2.5%.
Okay, so you're not starting with a figure of 800,000 and getting 24,000.
Because
so
we didn't
two
test
and a half,
all those
so you're,
people.
You're going in the opposite direction.
And so when I counted up the numbers that were ill in the towns and the reports and like that, that seemed about right. It was a kind of a comfortable figure that it seemed to suggest. So what it would do was silence entire communities and towns as it go through. You might see 2,000 or 3,000sick in a town like, say, Dundalk, or 1,000 in a town like New Ross, all under medical care at the same time. You'd see things like businesses shut down, not because of not because they were instructed to do so, but because the staffs were just gone sick.
Right. So where does that leave us in 2020, when we are almost certainly looking at more serious cases than there are intensive care beds? How do you decide who gets looked after and who doesn't? Dr. Chris Luke started a frankly blood-chilling conversation with Sarah McInerney on The Weekend on One.
But we are facing into really, really historically decisive decision, you know, considerations such as triaging the young as opposed to the old, the relatively young as opposed to the relatively old. Dealing with the fact that
what do you mean by that? Do you mean?
Well, I mean, you know, Peter has raised the issue of, you know, are we going to say, right, we have too few intensive care unit beds and hospitals to deal with the vast numbers of very, very sick, moribund people over the age of 75 and 80. And at the same time, we have hundreds of people who are in their 40s and 50s at their peak productivity in terms of the state and the social contract, which he mentioned. So, you know, are we going to prioritise intensive unit care of the young and productive as opposed to those who are elderly?
And you think that's a discussion that needs to be had now?
I think that one of the advantages of this coronavirus epidemic is that we are now having to have really very difficult discussions that we have put off for years and years about capacity, about the social contract, and about the fact that we're all living longer and longer, and we haven't got enough nursing home beds, and never mind intensive care unit beds.
No medication without taxation. And I'm just going to leave that ball in the air because, frankly, I don't know what to do with it. But I do know that Chris Luke wouldn't have started the conversation if his expert opinion wasn't that it's another debate that needs to be had.
Good morning, everyone. I need to speak to you about coronavirus and COVID-19.
Left untreated with a good dose of decisive government action, the Leinster House rumour mill had been breeding like a dirty petri dish throughout the week. Each passing hour brought a new bit of gossip about when the Taoiseach would be ramping up our response. It came in Sean O'Rourke's airtime on Thursday.
We've not witnessed a pandemic of this nature in living memory, and this is uncharted territory for us. We said we would take the right actions at the right time, and we have to move now to have the greatest impact. So from 6 p.m. today, the following measures are being put in place, and they will stay in place until the 29th of March. Schools, colleges and childcare facilities will close from tomorrow. Where possible, teaching will be done online or remotely. Cultural institutions will close as well. Our advice is that all indoor mass gatherings of more than 100 people and outdoor mass gatherings of more than 500 people should be cancelled. Arrangements are being made to ensure that everyone entering Ireland through airports and airports is fully informed and self-isolates if they develop symptoms. You should continue to go to work if you can, but where possible you should work from home. And in order to reduce unnecessary face-to-face interaction in the workplace, break times and working times should be staggered and meetings done remotely or by phone. Public transport will continue to operate. The shops will remain open, and we have plans to ensure that supply chains will not be interrupted. We need public and businesses to take a sensible, level-headed and responsible approach during this difficult time. Restaurants, cafes and other businesses can stay open, but should look at ways they can implement public health advice on social distancing. And as a general rule, outside of work, people should seek to reduce social interactions as much as possible. You can all play your part by hand-washing, coughing and sneezing into your elbow or a tissue, and seeking medical advice if you develop symptoms. This is now more important than ever. The Cabinet will meet later today. Opposition party leaders and counterparts in Northern Ireland and Britain will be briefed. In the period ahead, the government will deploy all of the resources we can muster, human and financial, to tackle this threat head on. Those resources are extensive, but not unlimited. Our healthcare workers have been at the forefront of this crisis since it started, and they will be at the front line of the crisis in the time ahead. We must do all that we can to help them so they can help those who need the help the most.
The collective sigh of relief from those worried that we weren't doing enough was audible, but it was matched by a drop in atmospheric pressure as the parents of the country gasped at the thought of now 4 weeks at home with the little treasures.
It's a bit much, isn't it? They're going a bit crazy over it, but I suppose it's very serious.
I work in IT, so I'll try and work from home and coordinate with my husband so we can few hours on, few hours off type of thing, but it has to be done.
What do you think about being off for 2 weeks? What were you told?
I remember that I always need to wash my hands, do the, hey Victor, Because of the coronavirus.
Oh, I'm devastated. It's like they're scaring everyone terrible. Like, what's going on even? Of course, the kids are terrified. Yeah, they're constantly talking about it, constantly.
So what does your 2 weeks look like, the next 2 weeks look
well,
like?
Well, Lily's
you?
Going down to Kerry to our nanny, so she doesn't want to go down. But it's very rural, so she'd have a great chance of not getting it down there, so...
Like, I understand that it has to be done, but it's kind of hard when both our jobs, like, aren't closing. So we're kind of left in limbo as to what we do with the kids.
I have 5 children and 1 more on the way, mother of 6, just about. I have 2 young kids in school and then 1 in creative kids. So my nerves still be gone. And I am so, so, so happy that the schools is closed.
What will you do now for the next 2 weeks?
Invite family over that is not sick. And hopefully we'll have the coronavirus over and done with soon.
Della Kilroy taking parents' temperatures after the Taoiseach's announcement on drive time.
I can understand why, you know, the medical practitioners are re-emphasising the idea of wash our hands. But is anybody telling us what to do with our minds in a time like this?
I think we're going to have to look to this. And, you know, it's timely that we're having this conversation. I know it's already emerging. I see it on the mental health websites now suddenly popping up today. The management of fear.
Could there be a more appropriate name for a programme right now than Leap of Faith? Last night, Michael Cummin talked to psychiatry professor Jim Lucy.
What happens is that people rush forward with anxieties and panics that become collective. And that can be mitigated only by leadership, by clarity, by strong, I think, faith in the idea that there is a knowledge base we can really adhere to. We don't have to listen to every tittle-tattle. So in terms of managing the modern-day anxiety, we try and encourage people not to do social media, not to listen to everything on Twitter, actually to shut down the social media at night and go to sleep if they can, to check in appropriately on their own symptoms, but be guided by an official channel of information. The HSE website, the Corona website, is absolutely super. And it's updated as it should be. Not to fear that it's going to constantly be updated, but to actually celebrate the fact that the update will be there. I don't need any other updates. I can now get on with the rest of my life and be guided by that instruction. And there's a sense in which management of anxiety, societal panic, and the urgency that this has brought on people is the priority now. Because if we don't manage it that way, we'll go around with panic buying or with avoidance of the correct information and the preference for chaotic behaviours.
So this would become the start of, you know, the rumours and the conspiracy theories and the stuff that we tend to go to look for an explanation.
And that kind of desire for rumours comes from our, I suppose, our fear that, you know, we'll be left out, that there's some other information we won't have. And that's why leadership comes in. We do need, and I think we're getting some strong leadership, but we need to coalesce around that leadership. Mm. And out of that becomes something that could be very good, which is a remembrance that we are a society, that health was never an isolated thing, that actually it was always about collective well-being, that the future of our health and public health is about a recognition of the value of clean air, clean water, immunisation, the need for all of us. My health, because your immune status matters to you, also matters to me because my immune status matters to you. And so we have a circle of connectedness.
A circle of connectedness rather than a source of contagion. That's quite a powerful idea to reflect on. And while we're here, can we get 3 cheers for the experts, please? For the emergency doctors, the disease historians, the epidemiologists that you've been listening to on radio all week. Expertise and actually knowing better than the rest of us fell out of fashion for quite a while. But the experts waited politely in the corner, knowing that we would all come scuttling back to them eventually. More of them after these.
I'm going to say goodbye to Conor Pope and Simon Calder, and thank you both very much. Mairead McGuinness, if you could stay with me for a minute, because we've received a statement from Fianna Fáil. I gather a similar statement being released by Fine Gael now.
On RTE Radio COVID-19, Mary Wilson interrupted normal virus programming on Tuesday to break the news that the grand pandemic might be about to end civil war politics and give rise to a grand coalition.
And it says the leaders of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have held constructive discussions over the last 2 days about a series of policy issues and the current political situation. They've decided teams from the two parties should now commence in-depth detailed talks. Both parties are also to continue discussions with the Green Party, and they enter the talks as equal partners determined to develop proposals which will serve the interests of the people of Ireland. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I'm reading it just as you read it to me, so I suppose it is hot off the presses. To some extent, I'm not surprised by the statement. I had got a sense in which the coronavirus crisis really has, you know, if you like, shaken everybody, and the need to have a stable government is really important.
It turned out that peace had already broken out between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael in the European Parliament, as they realised they're not that different after all.
I did jest with some of the Fianna Fáil MEPs in the corridors today that we perhaps will have to be better friends.
Within Fianna Fáil, it was a De Valera, Eamon O'Queeve, who said that the coronavirus shouldn't be the cause of ending the enduring schism of national politics.
Can I put to you what your party colleague Eamon O'Queeve has been tweeting overnight? He's saying that the coronavirus is not a mandate for a long-term government. He says that a national government set up for a short but defined period would be more effective. What do you say to that?
Well, I think there are a number of issues that arise from the suggestion of a national government.
Brian Dobson was talking to Michael McGrath.
First of all, it is time limited to the duration of the corona crisis, and we don't know how long that will be. I think it would be very difficult to get it together. There are also other issues that need to be dealt with, and planning has to be put in place and actions taken to deal with the housing crisis, to deal with the wider issues in the health service, and to start making progress in tackling the climate and biodiversity emergency. And so I think it would be very difficult to get agreement across the full spectrum of Dáil Éireann on all of those issues.
But I think it's also accepted that the result of the election was also a mandate for change. And one wonders how, after 4 years of confidence and supply with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, how another 4 or 5 year government of your two parties would actually represent any change at all.
Well, I mean, first of all, Fianna Fáil was not in government for the last 4 years. We were in opposition, and yes, we did provide a confidence and supply agreement because of the need, as we saw it, for political stability given the emerging Brexit issue. So this would be a very different arrangement if it were to come to pass. If Fianna Fáil were to enter government, we would clearly have a very significant influence in that government.
But Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael were getting a little bit ahead of themselves. The Greens, who they both assumed would want to be the filling in their end of civil war sandwich, said, no, we want a national government to deal with the corona crisis.
It didn't receive the consideration that we were hoping, certainly. We think that this is a time of national crisis. We think that it requires us to unite and to focus on that crisis.
Green Party TD Nasa Hourican talked to Audrey Carvel, whom the more eagle-eared of you will spot is also remote working from home.
So it is disappointing that I feel that you know they didn't really take very long to think about it at all.
So do you now cover your blushes and go back into talks with both parties about forming a government, or do you stay out?
No, I think that, look, first of all, we'd have to come together as a group anyway and discuss that. But I think we're, look, I stood on doorsteps up and down Dublin Central, and I never promised people that I wouldn't necessarily go in with any particular party. But what we did promise people is that we would negotiate a programme for government based on policy. Now, what we know is, in the middle of a crisis, it's not appropriate now for us to be going through and doing the kind of granular, important work of making a programme for government for 5 years while there are people ill, while there are people, you know, in hospital dying. So we've already heard from the two bigger parties, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, who are trying to make a government, that actually they agree. They're not interested now in doing those serious policy talks. Mm. What they want to do is fast-track a government, divvy up the ministries and get on with it.
So are you in the right possible.
At the moment, we'd have to meet again, but I can't see us going back into those talks now.
On Sunday, billionaire financier Dermot Desmond rode into the housing crisis with the not exactly unheard of idea that the state needs to build more social houses.
Our parents and forefathers, they left us Ireland a better place. We have a responsibility to do the same thing and leave it a better place for our children and our descendants. Will we not do that if we allow them to live in the rented accommodation? Every parent wants their child to have a home and a job. We're not giving them the opportunity to have a home. I, at a very low level clerk in the bank, I was able to buy my first house. Now, people in a similar situation can't do that. I think that, and our economy has improved. How can we say we've improved as a country over the last 40 years when you can't buy a house when you're starting off?
Owen O'Brien is Sinn Féin's housing expert, who's been saying something similar for a long time. He emailed Dermot to say, let's have a chat.
He rang on Monday and we had a conversation about exactly the further detail that I suppose lies behind both his strong criticism of government policy and some of the policy alternatives that he's put out there for public consideration.
They agreed on a lot, as Owen told Sean O'Rourke. And the sting in the tail question from a listener, well, it actually ended up stinging RTE.
Last question, maybe there's a quick answer to it. It's prompted by a text. Did Owen O'Brien ask Dermot Desmond why he was objecting to homes being built behind Aylesbury Road? Strictly speaking, I think it's his wife that's objecting, but it's a building project right beside us here on the old RTE land.
One of the concerns that many of us have, and the Montrose site is a good example, is that it's not just about delivering more homes, but the right kind of homes in the right places at the right location. So my big concern, of course, is that Montrose land was sold off at such a high price. And that means that the price of those homes to rent or buy would be out of reach of the vast majority of working people who live in that part of Dublin. Those kinds of lands should be mobilised to deliver good quality homes for working people. So I've no involvement and I don't know the details of the SHD objection. But I have to say, if people think building luxury apartments on what was essentially public land is a good way to tackle the housing crisis, they clearly don't understand the problem.
Perhaps one of the reasons that we get planning and housing so badly wrong, argued geographer Ruth McManus in this week's Davis Now lecture, was that we instinctively still think of ourselves as more properly a rural society, transplanted into an alien urban environment.
If you ask the average Dublin person where they're from, even those born in the city like myself are quite likely to qualify the statement by saying that their parents are from Clare or that they always cheer for the Offaly hurling team. Few would actually claim to be city people through and through. It's a fact that more people in Ireland live in towns and cities than in the countryside. Since the 1970s, the majority of Ireland's population has lived in urban areas. However, a recent study has suggested that Irish people living in urban areas are not as happy as their rural counterparts. In the time that I've been interested in cities, I've noticed an increasing tendency among people to discuss aspects of urban life. Every time I open a newspaper, or even overhear a conversation in a cafe, there's a mention of something to do with the shaping of Ireland's cities and towns. But such discussions are almost invariably couched in negativity. The problems of traffic, commuting, lack of planning, suburban sprawl, and so on. In fact, listening to the discussions, what becomes apparent is that we're creating spaces for cars, not people, and that our urban areas are felt to be badly planned and less than pleasant places to be in.
Dermot Desmond's non-expert opinion on housing was only listened to because he is a billionaire, argued some. Why are we all in the thrall of people just because they're rich? Fair point. But what harm also to have different perspectives? Perhaps why Sinead Crowley thought to ask The Handmaid's Tale author Margaret Atwood about pandemics on International Women's Day.
You have written about a pandemic. You have written about, I know,
I'm not alone.
Exactly. Are you surprised at how the world is dealing with this, with the coronavirus, with COVID-19? We're all talking about
it.
So.
We've been there before, and quite recently with SARS, which killed a higher percentage of people, but the incubation rate was shorter. So each of these things has a trajectory, and each of them has a possible antidote. So a possible vaccine is just a question of the length of time taken to develop it. So the flu of 1919 killed a huge number of people because science was not as advanced as it is now. However, just to give you a spot of hope, my mother's entire family got that one, and none of them died.
If the existential dread hasn't soured the milk in your cornflakes by now, this will. Last Saturday, Bob Geldof was chatting to Richard Curran about the privileged access that his profile gets him. One recent invitation was to a laboratory where scientists were working on stem cells, which will, in time, develop treatments to alleviate all kinds of human suffering.
The woman who's now in charge of this, who ran the SARS, she was listening and she eventually said, "It won't make any difference, Bob." And I said, "Well, why?" And she said, "Because there's a chicken in China right now and it's breeding a little bug. And we won't be able to stop that because the supply chains of the world, transportation." And she said, "Before it's lived its life, 60% of the world will be gone." So that's utter collapse. That's the Black Death. And it's not coronavirus. It will happen. It may not be that, but something akin is the thing that'll put it all out of shape. Would I have thought that? Would I have been exposed to that? Would I have been exposed to that brain power, to that beauty of whole unseen universes? Absolutely not. So why do I do it? Because of all of that. And that spins off in my head, and then there's a pop song that may be a hit. And then I get to play that. And when I'm on that stage, then I don't have to think about coronavirus or doubt or equivocation or the bottom line of some company in Africa. I just go wild and go free.
If you're beginning to feel nostalgic for other, simpler, unwelcome threats to our way of life, like Brexit, Geldof had been ruminating on those who say that Boris Johnson and his advisor Dominic Cummings are creative punk disruptors, the political answer to the Sex Pistols.
Trump and Brexit are punk. It's rejection of all norms, and Trump's case of behaviour, of civic dignity. Political norms, in some cases, disruption is useful. It is creative disruption. In the case of the United States, it's just destruction. The man is a fool, and the much, no pun intended, trumped economic resurgence of America is a bald lie. It is built on $1.9 trillion of debt, which uniquely America can possibly sustain because it just prints bucks, being the reserve currency. But that's up for grabs within 8 to 10 years with China. But he'd be out of there by then. But the nature of the confusion and chaos of the world leads to individuals like mafia gangsters like Putin or like Boris Johnson. That's it. And Brexit is classically punk. Dominic Cummings is, just that. The difference is
Johnny Rotten
was creative. Johnny Rotten was a brilliant paradigm of the now. Johnny made genius music. Boris Johnson will not create one of the greatest economies. He is not. He's just, all he wanted was power. He's unprincipled. He has no idea what to do with this thing. They flounder around making their silly juvenile punkish type things, getting rid of the institutions that they require to govern in the first place. So stand by for chaos. Johnny Rotten created the void in which new music could grow, and in so doing got rid of the old tired war horses.
Bob Geldof's expert analysis of why Brexit is not punk on The Business.
There's a shady figure moving around in the darkness. He's busy popping pills out of their foil and plastic packet into a cup. He's mashing them up. When he's done, he mixes up the powder with some surgical spirits until the pills dissolve. Then he adds orange juice and shakes the whole mixture up, pouring it back into the bottle.
There's two people who should have been experts on Ireland's most prolific serial killer, Kieran Patrick Kelly. Kelly himself and the policeman who arrested him. Oh.
Get lost, go on. Go away.
Sorry, that was just Rosie the cat trying to get in the window, showing that remote working has its own unique set of challenges. Anyway, as I was saying, the two people who should have been experts on Kieran Patrick Kelly, Ireland's most prolific serial killer, were Kelly himself and the policeman who arrested him. But the gripping premise of the documentary on One Team's podcast series, The Nobody Zone, is that nobody is as reliable a narrator as they would have you believe. Kelly, homeless in London, confessed to murdering many other homeless people. But in this week's episode, it is increasingly unclear which murders he committed and which he didn't.
The police found a homeless man who had died in a way that fits what Kelly described. He choked to death. But Kelly's unsure about the exact date at which the murder took place, as he'd done some prison time that year.
Jason, I'm telling you, I don't know.
Very important, Kelly, this one.
No, honestly, if you get me put £1,000 there, I just cannot tell you yes or no. I cannot say yes or no.
You can't say whether it was before or after.
Before or after.
Kelly, who was used to going to prison, calls his prison time bird.
So you see me record, I'm in and out there. I can't remember the fuck. All them dates, I go in, the dates have come out.
No,
I'm interested in the dates. I go in and do the bit of board and then I come out and that's it.
The dead man the police had identified was called Patsy Walters. And Kelly has agreed that he was the victim. But problem is that the police know that Kelly was in prison at the time Patsy Walters died.
But you were in prison when Patsy Walters died.
And then that's not the same one.
But you see, you're playing a game with us, Kelly. No. You're laughing again. You're playing
a game, that's it. Right. I could go, meet a fella and he could turn around and say, I'm Patsy Walters. And I'd fucking kill him.
Kelly couldn't have killed Patsy Walters. It must have been someone else.
Come on, tell us the truth, Kelly.
Fine.
Come on.
Dead. That's it, I'm telling you.
Patsy Walters, come on, tell us the truth. Who's that photograph, Kelly?
I don't know.
Who's the photograph? Kelly, it's Patsy Walters, isn't it?
It's a bad photograph.
Yeah. Okay.
There will no doubt be self-isolation panic downloading of podcasts. Do yourself a favour and get in ahead of the curve and listen to the Nobody Zone. And mums and dads, while the little darlings are standing there with one arm as long as the other saying, what'll we do now, for the next 4 long weeks, here's an RTE podcast tailor-made for you.
Welcome to RTE Junior's We Love Books, where we just love everything about kids' books. We love the stories, the pictures, the topics, the humour. We love when it gets a bit weird and a bit disgusting. We love when it gets a bit magic and fantastical. We love it all. My name is Niamh, and today we're getting furry but deadly.
This week, X Factor presenter Dermot O'Leary talked to Niamh McManus about his trilogy of children's books, Toto the Ninja Cat, based on a real-life character.
We realised quite early that Toto was almost 100% blind, but she had incredible reactions, so she could see breaks in light and so forth.
Wow.
And so we started calling her our little ninja, and then before you know it, like all people with pets, you kind of create their double life, don't you, a little
yes.
bit?
Yes.
And before we know it, I had these ideas for the books. And then, so I had one idea, and then suddenly I've sort of created, as the books have gone on, this whole other world that cat, the animals of the UK and the whole world, actually, but it's mainly based in London, live this kind of subterranean and nocturnal life.
Yeah, it's much more exciting than mine.
It's much more exciting. I mean, cats are very cool.
So yeah,
it's
cats
much
are very
more exciting
cool.
than all of ours, to be fair.
I'd like to go to Castonbury.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about Toto's latest adventure for the kids who maybe haven't heard of Castonbury?
Sure. Well, so she's had the first two books, she's peppered with adventure. So Toto is actually it transpires that she's been recruited by Larry, the 10 Downing Street cat, to be his deputy as the UK branch of the Ancient Order of the International Cat Ninjas. And so Dublin would have its
job.
Own
yes.
Cat ninja of making sure that the president, prime ministers around the world don't do anything stupid. They're just to keep an eye on the humans, just to make sure they don't do anything stupid. So Toto's had a couple of missions. She's exhausted. She's absolutely knackered and she needs some time off. And so Silver, her brother, and her best friend Catface, who's a rat who lives his life like a cat, who looks a lot like a cat, they come up with an idea that they should go to the annual music festival of Castonbury. And Toto doesn't really want to go. She's kind of tired and she just wants to have a couple of weeks off where she just eats, sleeps and cleans herself. Which is what most cats do, 20 hours of the day. And but they convince her, and so they go down, and she thinks it's going to be a nice, fun weekend, and of course there's a massive crime going on, and so she has to save the day.
For what it's worth, the pretty harsh critics in the Boucher Hayes household gave both Toto the Ninja Cat and We Love Books 2 thumbs up. I was last Sunday years old when I found out that two outstanding experts in their own fields, the neurologist Orla Hardiman and the BAFTA award-winning filmmaker Nasa Hardiman, were sisters. I know, it was in the name really, wasn't it? They talked to Miriam O'Callaghan on International Women's Day about two jobs that couldn't be more different, but are both ultimately about understanding people.
I think from the pursuit of an understanding of disease and the pursuit of engaging with an unmet need, and also a need where it's there's a sense of hopelessness. You know, the disease is clearly, you know, it's always fatal. I think that it's the same sort of thing that NASA's saying, that you need a lot of things that you have to develop in yourself to be able to engage with people who are going to who have a condition that we actually can't treat. So it was a combination of the scientific training that I got in the US, the scientific training that I maintain and that I continue to pursue, along with that sort of existential, emotional, human...
There are soft skills, yeah.
Yeah, interaction.
My daughter did a transition year week with Orla and came away really, really deeply impressed by that, because she's inherited that family interest in science and has ended up in theoretical physics. But she came away from that week with Orla saying, I had no idea how much of her practice is about the interpersonal, about the nuance, about the narrative. And decoding that and making a warm connection with the person across
and that narrative is really important. Actually, we've talked about that. NASA does it. She and the way that she tells stories, she tells good screenwriters, and NASA's a brilliant screenwriter as well as being a brilliant director, are about getting into making us as the observers get into the shoes of the person that they're telling the story about. And for me, I have to be able to do that in my clinic, but I have to also be able to preserve the professional distance. And so actually they're very similar.
All human activity is about making you forget that you're going to have to die, film director John Borman told Miriam last Sunday as well. A diversion that was completely ruined for him 1 week into the filming of The General with Brendan Gleeson, when a doctor told him he would die if he didn't go and get a heart bypass immediately.
And I said, well, I can't do that. I'm shooting a picture. It's much more important than life and death. So he said, well, that's very foolish of you. But he said, be very careful about, don't run up the stairs or do... And he put me on a diet. So I went through shooting the whole picture in this condition, thinking at any moment I was going to get a heart attack. And so as soon as the picture was over, I went to Los Angeles, I had to go there anyway, went to a top cardiologist, and he sent his camera up through my groin. It went all around my veins, arteries and heart and everything else. And he said, you're absolutely fine. There's no clotting of, any kind. And he said, you won't ever have bypass. You never have a bypass. You never will have. He said, you'll probably die of something much more painful. So I said, well, how do I get that diagnostic? Well, he said, we call it a false negative. I had all that mental distress. It took all the pleasure out of making the film. But
there was nothing wrong with
you. I survived. And of course, the irony is that if you do something like making a film, something very intensive, the whole purpose of it is that it makes you forget that you have to die. All human activities, intensive activities, are all designed to make you forget that you're going to have to die. And that's so I was stripped of that that pleasure.
During The General.
Yeah.
To end this morning, a word, or more accurately, two words from a man with no little expertise in the use of words. President Michael D. Higgins heard on A Leap of Faith yesterday for anyone feeling overwhelmed by the scale of what we're facing into.
I think that to take the two most important words, and maybe in the English language, are take care, to take care of themselves and to take care of others, and to be sensible, and everything passes, and this too will pass, and it will have the the least consequences when in fact people are very, very careful, but very particularly, I think I say it in my St. Patrick's Day message, is to look at those who are maybe alone and those who are elderly and those who may be disturbed and about it. They need us to help them and to watch out for them. And they would say, you know, we would tuiadado, that we would say, take care.
Oaktaron, Curve Margaret.
Fortunately.